Thank you. It's so nice to be here and talk about these topics that are near and dear to our hearts. So this is the HIV care cascade that everyone is so familiar with. And you can see that nationally, we have about 82% of those living with HIV who have been diagnosed. And that's what we're going to talk about today is this part of the care cascade, not all the other gaps that we also need to address. We're really interested in why we have racial ethnic disparities in HIV testing rates. Not terrible in HIV testing rates, but in engagement to care we have serious racial and ethnic disparities. The disparities have been well documented. Now I think we need to really move to why they exist and why they are perpetuated. But let's talk about heterosexual HIV. It's not insignificant. It's about a quarter of new HIV diagnoses. It does tend to be underreported. People often are assigned to unknown risk, and it disproportionately affects women and people of color, and it's tied to the epidemics among men who have sex with men and injection drug users. In New York City, we are one of the sites for the CDC and Department of Health-funded NHBS studies, which estimate surveillance in different populations. And so these are some of the findings from our local NHBS. So why do heterosexuals in New York City have higher rates of HIV infection? You know, the stereotype, or at least the beliefs have been that it's because you have a lot of sexual risk behavior and a lot of injection drug use is actually not the case. The numbers of sexual partners for these populations are low or average rates of unprotected sex, but there are some factors driven by structural and social issues that are relevant. High rates of concurrent partnerships and non-injection drug use, high rates of sexually transmitted diseases, low rates of HIV testing, which we'll talk about today, and then sexual mixing with high risk individuals. So one of the aims of this conference is to really point out that where you live makes a big difference, and for heterosexuals, where you live makes all the difference. So this is a map of New York City, and this shows you the highest rates of heterosexual HIV and the highest rates of poverty combined. It's a high-risk index, so it's not distributed normally across the population. There's clusters, so there's no coincidence that HIV and poverty coincide. So we focus on Central Brooklyn. This was the area in this city map that had the highest rates of HIV among heterosexuals. So we focus on neighborhoods like Bedford-Stuyvesant, Bushwick, Williamsburg, and then the surrounding areas. These are about the top 50% zip codes with the highest rates of heterosexual HIV based on Department of Health data and poverty rates. So we are doing three different models to find people with undiagnosed HIV infection. We do a lot of HIV testing. So we're doing a peer-driven intervention. We're testing about 3,000 people, venue-based sampling, and an innovative hybrid model where we start with anonymous testing, and if someone tests positive with us, we try to transition them to a confidential treat and retain phase. The data I'm going to talk about today come from the first one, the peer-driven intervention, the 3,000. This is our model from the literature of why heterosexuals tend to have lower rates of HIV testing than their peers. You can see it's really complicated. It's multi-level. The structural level, they have poor access to high-quality healthcare settings. There's healthcare, and there's HIV testing offered, but it might not be offered in a way that makes them want to do it. So at the social level, there's people report insufficient social support. They just can't handle an HIV diagnosis. They don't have the social resources to do it. And then peer norms about testing that are sort of specific to heterosexuals. Well, we're not at risk. You know, we're not drug users. We're not gay men. We're not at risk. And at the individual level, this first one is huge. Competing priorities associated with poverty. That alone could be a conference in and of itself. Not really being aware of the testing guidelines, low perceived risk, as I told you, and fear. You know, think about it. You're poor, you're struggling, you have kids to raise, and it could be very bad if you test positive, in your mind at least. I mean, we believe that HIV can be a tremendous opportunity for support and resources and services, but it's still can be a real crisis in someone's life. There's also distrust, distrust that comes out of hundreds of years of our nation's history of maltreatment of people of color by medical institutions and distrust of testing. And then have depression and anxiety. So this is what the theoretical model looks put all together. We've got demographics, we've got risk factors, and then for us as interventionists, the stuff in the middle box is what we would try to target in an intervention. And I'm going to tell you about our findings and which of these women and men said were most relevant in terms of promoting or inhibiting their getting tested for HIV in the past year. And I want to say that this problem of low rates of HIV testing takes place in a historical and cultural context that we really need to struggle to understand. I showed you the rates of HIV not normally distributed within our city. They're clustered. And that's a big factor in people's minds. So the kinds of factors at play here are structural inequalities that result in exclusion and discrimination. The fact that poverty is clustered, which means that it's not just you having trouble getting a box of Pampers, but everyone in your social network is struggling too. There's really nowhere to turn. Inequality is a huge issue. It's one thing if we're all in it together, we're all struggling, but it's very hard if you're struggling and someone drives by you with a $80,000 watch and a $200,000 car. It's not fair, and that makes people have feelings about things like healthcare. And then some other contextual factors that we don't have time to get into today. So in terms of this talk, our research questions, we know the CDC recommends annual testing for people at risk, at least annual. We wanted to look at what factors predict HIV testing in the past year. We have a multi-level model. We look at gender differences. And how can we take these findings to increase rates of HIV testing among heterosexuals at high risk? So just briefly about our methods, respondent-driven sampling. You get a bunch of initial seeds. You can get them on the street. They do a baseline interview, and then they're trained to recruit their peers. Women tend to be underrepresented in research, so you actually give special incentives and coupons only for women. So say you give someone three coupons, you say recruitment coupons, you say this one has to be used for a woman to get the enough women in your sample. And then the peers enroll and you continue till sample size goals are met. So here's a little bit about the sample. There's some gender differences. Women tend to be a little bit younger. They're mostly African American, some Latinos, mostly heterosexuals. This is a study of heterosexuals, so you would expect most of them to be heterosexuals. Very few transgender. About a third had completed their high school or GED. More men than women had done that. But the rates of economic stress are very high in this population. You can see over 78% that they ran out of funds for necessity in the past year. More men than women tended to do that. In terms of risk factors, this slide is very profound to think about what people are going through. More than half had ever been homeless. About a quarter, a little less than a quarter, a fifth were currently homeless. Look at the men, 75% ever incarcerated. I mean, we know that. This is in the news, but it's staggering to think in this sample, a substantial sample, how high it is. And of the women, 44%. That means being incarcerated is almost normal, which is wrong. And many had been incarcerated in the past year, more males than females. In terms of substance use, about half the men, fewer women, had used substances in the past year. And there's some drug and alcohol problems among men and women. Alcohol problems are about the same. Drug problems about the same. More men than women had tried to access substance use treatment. So women tend to be doing a little bit better than men on some of these indices. There's interest in smoking, as we know from this conference, and about half of the cohort smokes daily. And then in terms of health, they have health insurance, which is good. They feel their health's pretty good. The women, there's some differences that emerge here in terms of STI testing might be related to the fact that women have a mechanism for getting annual health care, or they should, and they also may get testing during pregnancy that men don't have. I'm a psychologist, so when I see rates of depression at these rates, it's very concerning to me. That is a public health problem that we have to address. You can see number of sexual partners. This is a mean, less than two in the past month. Not terribly high. In terms of these theoretical barriers to HIV testing, Their HIV knowledge is moderate. Their distrust of healthcare was moderate. Conspiracy beliefs, moderate. I'm just going to see if there's anything to point out. And we looked at whether they felt they were able to get medical care when needed. Actually, that's pretty low. 58% of women said yes. And how many barriers to care they experience and whether they feel they have access to HIV testing. Those are irrelevant because we put them in a multivariable model that we tested. So in terms of their HIV testing history, almost everyone had been tested at least once, but in the past year it was fairly low, 55% of women and 47% of males. And then we started to look at, well, what predicts HIV testing for women and men? And so these are factors in a multivariable model in order of magnitude, but in terms of what promotes or inhibits HIV testing. So for women, if they'd ever been tested for STIs in their lifetime, they're more likely to be tested. Having health insurance, having a high school degree meant you were less likely to be tested, and so on. I'm going to interpret these findings, so I'm not going to go through them in great detail here. So this is our model, again, that I showed you, and I circled just sort of where the action is from the perspective of women. So none of the individual influences that we're so interested in, fear and substance use, whatnot, predicted HIV testing for women, but perceived peer norms did. That's the thought that that my peers support my getting tested, my peers are getting tested for HIV. We do peer intervention, so that's very interesting to us. And then a lot of structural factors. We can't necessarily always change these structural factors as interventions, but we can get around them. So access, perceiving that you have access to healthcare, perceiving that you don't have barriers to medical care and that you have access to HIV testing, all promoted HIV testing in the past year. And then in terms of age, younger women were more likely to be tested, which is not what you'd necessarily expect. And if you've ever been tested for STIs, you're more likely to be HIV tested in the past year. So let's interpret this real quick. We need to understand more the relationships between STIs and HIV testing. Is it offered? Are you seeking it out? And in terms of age, we think it might be something associated with pregnancy, that women have this natural way of getting HIV tested, and that for that reason we need to really think about the older women. And so for men, I got 1 minute. Substance use got in the way of testing, perceived peer norms also promoted it. Access to HIV testing promoted it, obviously. A few other things, some structural factors. Homelessness and incarceration were places where men got tested. So it tells us that substance use interferes. We need to understand that better and go after those men. And we also are interested in the power of peer norms to promote HIV testing. So what can we do in 1 second? We need active outreach approaches to go after the ones with the highest barriers. Can we improve access to high-quality HIV testing? You know, in research, whether it's NHBS or our research, people say yes to high-quality HIV testing, but it's just when it's done maybe cursorily, or providers have barriers to offering it. So, you know, I've been offered HIV testing many times in New York where we have a law that says it has to be offered to you, but it's offered by someone saying, you don't want HIV testing, do you? And then they check off that they offered it. I can't tell you how many times this happened. Men need efforts outside of jail and homeless shelter and prison. Women know that they should be getting an annual checkup, but what about men? Maybe we need to boost that. I know this session's about women, but you can't address women's HIV risk without dealing with men. And we need to target older women and also men who use drugs for active approaches to HIV testing. And here's our wonderful research team. We're funded by NIDA, and thank you very much.